In other news.
To determine why and how the towers collapsed.
Kind of scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. In 1986, Dr. Warren Farrell published the bestseller Why Men Are the Way They Are that examined core problems within the female-male relationship dynamics. Dr. Farrell listened to women and men's groups that gave insight into the anger from women toward men and also learning how men felt about being objectified and mischaracterized. Dr. Farrell used role reversal exercises that in some cases revealed distortions programmed to women by corporate advertising in feminist magazines. It's been called a book for every woman who wants to understand her man and for every man who wants to understand himself. Why Men Are the Way They Are answers questions such as why can't men listen, or why are men threatened by successful women, and if women are so liberated, why do so many still like to have men pay for dinner and then call them in the morning? In one review, the book is described as, quote, a devastating expose of the hypocrisies of the sexual revolution. There are timeless insights in this book that offer counterpoints to the reignited feminist rhetoric of terms such as toxic masculinity. Dr. Warren Farrell joins us today to talk about his book, Why Men Are the Way They Are, but we'll also examine changes within relationship dynamics between men and women that may have occurred in the last 30 years. Dr. Farrell is an educator, activist, and author of 7 books on men and women's issues. His books include The Myth of Male Power, Women Can't Hear What Men Don't Say, Does Feminism Discriminate Against Men, and recently, The Boy Crisis. Dr. Warren Farrell, welcome to Another News.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Dr. Farrell, you've been a supporter of feminism and served on the New York City Board of the National Organization for Women, and you're also considered the father of the men's movement. Would you please give listeners some background of your work and career trajectory?
That sounds like an oxymoron. Maybe I'm just mixed up. So, here's the way it actually went down. In the late 60s, early 70s, when the women's movement sort of surfaced in its more modern form, I was very interested in it and changed my dissertation topic when I was doing my doctorate at NYU to be focused on the women's movement, and that led to my being elected to the board of directors of the National Organization for Women in New York City and being totally devoted for 3-4 years on their board, speaking around the world on the importance of women's issues to both women and also to men secure enough to hear the message. If you will, I was sort of the world's leading male feminist at the time, and that began to change a little bit when in the mid-70s I started seeing a lot of divorces, and I started saying, looking at tracking how the children of divorce were doing and seeing that many of the children of divorce were not doing well, and seeing that the early research was showing that the children of divorce who didn't have a lot of father involvement after divorce, they were the ones that seemed to be having the most problems. And so I started talking about this to people on the board of NOW, and I could see that there was not a great amount of receptivity to what I was saying, and so I pressed the issue, of course, knowing me, and the response was, well, we're getting a lot of emails, letters at that time and phone calls from NOW members saying that they don't want to have the NOW organization suggesting that after divorce that men have equal rights to children. We've been the mothers. We know what's best for the children. And if the father's being involved in the children's life is best, then we'll do that. But if not, what we want to have to say over that, and we're not going to be NOW members if you're sort of suggesting that we're not going to have that right. And so NOW felt caught between, their response to me was, Warren, we have more things at stake for equality than just custody issues. If we start splitting out women who support us from women who don't support us for these types of reasons, we're going to lose membership, and that's going to lose our political, edge in many other areas as well that we need. And I said, I really do understand that. And at the same time, it's really important for us to have our integrity, what I think think of as our integrity, which is to be really focused on what's best for the children after divorce. And the response was, well, we want women to have the freedom to raise children by themselves or to do what they want to after divorce. I said, women's freedom we all support, but when a woman makes a free choice to have children, she makes a free choice to make sure that everything she does from that point on is in the best interest of the child, as is a man who has, you know, who has a child. So the board members said in general, well, why don't you do more research on that and see if this is, you know, if children in fact don't do better when they're with their mothers. And so I did begin to do more research, but I really clearly had my message given to me, which is that if my research found that children did better when they have a significant amount of father contact, that I was going to lose the support of now. And the support of now, what that was for me was, you know, I was doing about 50 speaking engagements a year and was honored in every place that I went to all over the world. And I was doing constant TV shows on Phil Donahue, which was the, you know, the 70s equivalent of Oprah Winfrey, and in People magazine and Parade magazine, and written up very positively in the New York Times and all the major papers around the world. And so, I, you know, the part of me that wanted to continue having this type of response, you know, was very fearful. But then, you know, because I was getting my doctorate, I felt I was, you know, I would at least have, you know, if I did follow the research and not, you know, not what I was being told was would get me the most fame or money, that at least I would be able to have, you know, I'd be able to teach somewhere, perhaps, and you know, with a PhD, et cetera. And so I just decided to do what I felt was, I just decided to follow the research, and the research increasingly over the past, you know, 40, 50 years has shown without a shadow of a doubt that basically, the boy crisis resides where dads do not reside. And in a way, we knew this from the Moynihan Report in 1965, when there was a study of inner city children, and the study of Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was a U.S. Senator and Secretary of Labor under the Nixon and Johnson administrations, was very clear that children were not doing well. It wasn't because of race in the inner city. It was because of that portion of the African American community where there was minimal or no father involvement. It was that portion of the community where the children, and especially the boys, were likely to become criminals and join gangs, drop out of school, be unmotivated. So this was already apparent in 1965, but in 1965, only 25% of children of African American families were fatherless, or what I call dad deprived, and only 3.5% of children in Caucasian communities were dad deprived. Now the figure is about 32-33% in Caucasian communities, so it's higher now in Caucasian communities than it used to be in African American communities, where when the Moynihan Report discovered what I'm discovering in much greater numbers and percentages all around the world in industrialized countries, developed countries, where there's permission for divorce and permission for children to be raised in single mom families.
That definitely seems like a critical turning point for you, Dr. Farrell. And continue on that thread for a minute. What is your read on women's radical feminists, members of NOW? What is your read on their inclusion of fathers now? How do they assess this now based on the health of the child?
Yes, I wish I could say that, you know, since the Boy Crisis book came out, which really, you know, used this came out last year, and I was able to, you know, gather, you know, 10 chapters of amazingly solid research showing 70 ways that children who do not have dad involvement are suffering from being much, and that boys, and that while these 70 ways, most of them are true for girls and women, they are more true for boys and men, because boys don't have two things. One, they don't have dad-deprived boys do not have a role model of their own gender. And then secondly, they also don't have They don't have the encouragement to express their feelings and ask for help, as girls and women are more prone to do. And so that leads to boys, you know, girls and boys both having significant problems when there's a lack of father involvement, but boys' problems being much greater. A good example of this is that when boys are at the age of 9.5, there was a huge study done of boys and girls who didn't have father involvement at the age of 9.5, and their telomeres, that is, their telomeres were already 14% shorter. The telomeres are the part of your cells that hold the genes that can prevent heart disease and cancer. And the shorter they are, if they're about 14% shorter at the age of 9.5, that's a predictor of about a 14% shorter life expectancy. However, the male telomeres are yet again 40% shorter than the female, their sister's telomeres, which gives you a sense of the power of dad deprivation in terms of even such scientific things as our life expectancy as measured by the length of our telomeres. And so these are things that we just didn't know when I started, you know, when I was with the Board of Now. And you know, but there are just hundreds and hundreds of examples like this that I was able to document in the Boy Crisis. And so I was hoping, cause, you know, I love women, and I still consider myself in many ways a feminist, if feminism is defined as understanding that we're all in the same family boat, and that whenever one sex only wins, then everybody loses. But feminism has not been defined that way recently. It's been defined much more in the hashtag MeToo sense, and the hashtag MeToo is, of course, extremely important, but it's very important that women speak up. But what is also important is that there not be a hashtag MeToo monologue. There has to be a hashtag MeToo dialogue. Men and women look at things in very different ways, Mars-Venus types of ways. And even though we have all the fluidity talk today, and that's very valid and important, but there's also fundamental differences when men and women, when men are expected to take the initiatives in the sexual sense, and then if they move too fast, they're oftentimes called a sexual harasser. If they don't move fast enough, they're called a wimp. And boys are still caught in this experience today and have to talk about their experience, even as they hear and listen to women and girls talk about their experience. And that's the dialogue that has to happen. Feminists have not been, so I find this ironic thing. Here I am a political liberal, and I ran for, you know, governor of California as a Democrat. And I'm in a position where the Boy Crisis book comes out, and it's going to thousands of TV and radio stations, and almost all my interviews are among conservative stations that say, you know, we have been saying that fathers are important and families are important for years, and feminists have not been responding, and most liberal and mainstream media have producers who are feminists in their orientation, and they have reached out, and some of them have responded immediately, but then some producer along the way blackballs it, and it doesn't appear for the most part, WBAI being an exception, on radio and TV shows and in the mainstream, New York Times and Wall Street Journal.
Yes, I find that particularly interesting, and I want to talk about that specifically because I'm glad you brought that up. But speaking of dialogue, this is what I really like about your book, Why Men Are the Way They Are. Would you talk about how important it was to hold workshops with women and men's groups in establishing baseline research for that book?
Yes. For many years, I sort of formed, whenever I spoke, I would pass out yellow pads of paper to the men, and then and also different pads to the women. And women and men would sign up for creating men's consciousness-raising groups, which is what they were called at times, which was basically support groups with a feminist filter. And so I formed hundreds of those, and what I did is stayed oftentimes till one or two in the morning if I could get the custodians to keep the auditorium open, and sat around on the stage and taught the groups how to sort of to form and to sustain themselves and so on, and then try to keep in best contact possible with those groups. And this gave me a huge amount. It was the after contact that really gave me a huge amount of information about, you know, what the groups found important. And then I would go around to colleges and universities and do experiences. I found that when I gave lectures, people gave me standing ovations. But a year later, I didn't remember pretty much anything that I said, and so it had really no impact on their life. So I started to do role reversal experiences, and I said to every man in my audience, you know, every woman is in a beauty contest every day of her life. So if you really want to walk a mile in the moccasins of what women go through, come up here on stage and be part of this beauty contest of everyday life. And then I had the women be the judges and whistle and make comments about which men they liked the best. And then those men became finalists, and then those finalists were asked moral virtue questions and to do something to show how talented they were. And then all the female judges observed that. And the guys came out of that experience saying, my God, you know, here I was on the one hand trying to compete to be the most attractive guy on stage, and on the other hand feeling resentment that no one was appreciating me for anything except my attractiveness, and I have a lot more to me than my attractiveness. And the women in the audience were saying, yes, you got it. That's exactly what we experience, that dichotomy, that tension, that almost oxymoronic contradiction. And so then I said, but this is a role reversal experience. So I'm now going to ask all the women who will be making a significant amount of money. I gave them a whole formula to calculate how much they would be making 10 years after graduation, and or women who were already graduated. I asked the ones who were making the most money or would be making the most money to sit in the first rows, and all the way back to the ones making the least money sitting in the last rows. And then I retrained, I re-socialized, worked with the men to focus only on the women in the front rows under the role reversal experience, that they were going to be the primary caretakers of the children, and that they needed to be live in good neighborhoods and so on, and so that they should focus on a woman that could be able to provide the type of income that would allow their children to have the best schools and so on. Well, this left a lot of women in the back rows feeling left out, and so they could experience how men who don't earn much money often felt left out. And then I asked the women to come up and just get tuned into the men they were most attracted to, and then select the man they were most attracted to, and once selected, come up and try to ask that particular man out on a role reversal date, just 15, 20 minutes, in which their job was to at least take their hand and give them a kiss on the cheek goodnight at the end of the, quote, evening. And so the women did this, and the women came back, and they found that a lot of women were often competing, you know, for the one of the finalists. So often there were 5 or 10 women around these finalists. And so the women said, you know, up until this point in my life, every time I used the word jerk, that word was applied to a male. But today, when I was competing against these other women for this guy I was attracted to, I was telling him, you know, I could take him to this real good restaurant that I, in fact, could not afford, or I had this Porsche or a car that I didn't have, and I was lying, and then I found myself pulling him by his arm to separate him out from the other women just so I could have his attention for a few moments, and that was really, of course, jerk behavior. But, you know, what I found myself doing it, even though it was just a game, because I didn't want to be rejected, and I found myself sort of cutting this guy off as a human being and just objectifying him, because it hurt less to be rejected by an object than it did to be rejected by a full human being. And so I've never had this experience before. And some of these women, you know, some of the women were professors at the university or executives from the community, you know, who were very competent in their everyday life, but they were showing sweat under their armpits when it came to taking these risks of social rejection.
It is amazing to me how powerful the role reversal exercise is, and it's something that I really didn't think about, although it's very instinctive, a very instinctive move to do. Now, this book was written in 1986, yet recently, Dr. Farrell, I was on a flight, and two concepts explained in your book were revealed as we flew into the New York City area. The pilot had said that he flew military missions in Iraq with a chief warrant officer that was killed by enemy fire. He spoke about the heroics of this person and honored him in front of the plane full of passengers, and you could tell it was heartfelt, and the pilot was holding back tears. The passengers applauded him and the sacrifice his colleague made. So that was the first one, which is obvious to you. But later in the flight, the second part of this, a female flight attendant was telling a couple jokes on the intercom in the aircraft so every passenger could listen. She had a heavy southern accent, and one of the jokes went like this. There was a farming couple, and during planting season, the husband said to his wife, "Why are you growing these plants again, knowing you're just going to kill them?" And she replies, "Well, I want you to know what we're capable of." And after reading your book, I questioned, would a man telling that joke in the reversed role be fired effective immediately? Would you talk about those examples, please?
Yes, the last one is easier, more quick to talk about, so I'll start with that. Clearly, a man doing that today would be fired. But if a feminist woman were listening to this conversation, say, well, wait a minute, that really sitting behind that firing is the fact that men are the batterers of women. And so there's a real fear on the part of women that they will be subjects to victims of domestic violence. And so this doesn't happen in reverse, so therefore it can be a joke. And if, in fact, if that were true, there'd be some truth to what this feminist would be saying. But here is the reality. Since 1971, Strauss and Gellis, started doing the research, asking men and women around the country if they were victims of domestic violence. And they defined domestic violence as anything from being slapped by your partner all the way to having your partner shoot you but not kill you. And so that you'd be free later to answer this, the interview. And they found that men and women in relationships battered each other about equally, hit and at all levels of violence. Every feminist all around the country said that's ridiculous, bad research, bad methodology. So since then, more than 100 studies have been done of domestic violence, and almost every single one of them has found exactly what Strauss and Gellis found. And these are mostly studies done by women, and most of those women were feminists. Many of them set out to disprove what Strauss and Gellis found, and almost all of them have found the exact opposite, that this was accurate. Many that only believed women, as Strauss and Gellis, were more prone to do, asked women, were you the first one to initiate the violence? And the majority of the women said, yes, they were. And the great majority of men said, yes, the women were more likely to do that. But the important thing that I've just talked about is not that women and men are as likely to batter each other and be the initiators of domestic violence in relationships. Clearly, men are more violent outside of relationships. But in relationships, women are as violent toward men as vice versa, except in dating relationships, where women are much more likely to be violent toward men and initiate domestic violence or relationship violence in dating relationships than men are. So, and this is even more true recently when men have become more conscious of doing things like hitting a woman, whereas women have not become more conscious about doing that to men to nearly the same degree. So that's the easy one to answer. The hard one to answer, and by far the more profound one to answer, is the one about the heroic experience of the pilot revealing from his heart his fighter missions and somebody that he cared about dying. Here is what I talk about a great deal in both the Boy Crisis book and in The Myth of Male Power. I call it The Myth of Male Power. And the subtitle is why men are the disposable sex, because historically speaking, the way we were trained to get honor, admiration, and respect as a man was to be disposable. Every generation had its war, and in every generation's war, men, the young males, were shown pictures of men who were fighting in that war, and they learned from both mom and dad, but even dad more than mom, that, you know, your uncle was a Marine and your uncle did this, and so on. So boys learned basically throughout history a type of intelligence, and that's what I would call heroic intelligence, or intelligence to prepare them for a short life, as opposed to health intelligence, which is intelligence to prepare people for a long life. Boys did not learn to become human beings, having emotional intelligence, expressing feelings, speaking from their heart, talking of their pain, talking of their hurt, asking for help. They learned to become human doings. I'm Dr. Warren Farrell, author of the bestsellers, so-and-so. That's my human doing part of me, the doctor, the bestseller. That's my makeup. I use that to make up the gap between the power I have and the power that I'd like to have. It's the male equivalent of female makeup, which is also the makeup, making up the gap between the power she has and the power she would like to have. Since the Boy Crisis book has come out, I have received thousands of letters from parents who say, Dr. Farrell, my son has gone into 7th, 8th grade, and he's already hearing that boys have male privilege, and he feels like, and they're part of the patriarchy, and the patriarchy is men who have made rules to benefit men at the expense of women, and that therefore, when he speaks up, he shouldn't really speak up. It's women's time to speak up and men's time to shut up, and when he gives explanations about things, he's mansplaining. Well, if their son is bright, their son might say something like, wait a minute. And the word he hears most frequently about masculinity is the word toxic. And so he begins to hear that toxic masculinity is an example of that, is, you know, men getting angry rather than expressing their feelings, their hurt, and their pain in a more loving type of compassionate, vulnerable way. And so he expresses his feelings so he doesn't have toxic masculinity. And then he's told he's mansplaining. And then he's told, you know, that, you know, you should be very, you know, if he's in California, there's literally a law if he's in college that he can't reach out and take a woman's hand without asking her permission first, without being able to be vulnerable to being accused of sexual harassment. So he becomes extremely cautious about any woman he approaches. But he's still the one that's expected, for the most part, to approach women if anything is going to happen for him sexually. And yet, if he moves too quickly, he's called a sexual harasser. But when he moves very cautiously, he's called a wimp. And so this 14, 15-year-old boy is having all the, you know, he's the less mature sex, but he's still expected to risk rejection with the more mature sex. And he's confused and fearful. And so he withdraws if he's not really, you know, one of the superstars, like a football player, student body president, or great at sports, or, you know, really has great social skills and academic skills. He finds he's rejected, and he's so fearful of reaching out to women, he starts turning to porn instead. And the more porn he turns to, porn is basically access to a variety of attractive women without fearing rejection, at a price he can afford, by the way. But the problem with porn, of course, is that it addicts the brain. It stimulates dopamine for increasingly risky behaviors with women. So by the time he gets a real woman to be attentive to him in a potentially sexual way, the real woman is subjected to all the stuff he sees in porn in order to be able to turn him on, and she feels objectified, understandably. And so she, you know, withdraws from him, which only proves to him that he's not worthy of female companionship, and that returns him to more porn and more addiction to porn. And so this is the dynamic that is happening in a world where there's hashtag MeToo's that is a monologue but not a dialogue.
It is. I can't imagine growing up right now as a teenager, how interesting it might be and difficult, even though you have a universe of information at your fingertips. Would you please talk about how the Clinton presidential campaign in 2016, well, in my opinion, I thought it created a division between men and women.
Well, yes. So let me be clear first where my biases are. I was a Hillary Clinton supporter, not only a Hillary Clinton supporter, but I also gave advice to four different of her advisors. And my advice was that, you know, that first of all, the pay gap is not a gap about just that is based on discrimination. The pay gap between men and women is a gap between mothers and fathers. When mothers, you know, I had to write a whole book to explain this called Why Men Earn More and What Women Can Do About It. And in fact, there are 25 things that women can do about it. And I shared this type of thing with the Clinton campaign. And the Clinton advisors, for the most part, were, you know, like, oh, this is really interesting. I never thought of this way. We'll bring this up to Hillary Clinton. Well, I do not know whether, in fact, they did. But what I did know is that when I went to her fundraising rallies, even after this advice, wherever it went to, was given, there was never a single word of empathy toward boys' issues and boys' struggles that I talk about in the Boy Crisis book. And those struggles are numerous, so numerous that Jerome Powell, the Federal Reserve Chair, said that the Boy Crisis is is one of the two greatest threats to American economic future and success. But talking to the advisors about this, they could not get Hillary Clinton to say one single sentence that supported boys and men. The only exception of that rule was to say if you are in favor of women's issues that I'm talking about, like you oppose the pay gap and you believe that men earn a dollar for each 79 cents or whatever that that women earn for the same work, that even though she, I'm sure, knew that wasn't true, I had a chance at one point to talk with her about why that wasn't true, but it was the only time she ever said anything about boys and men's issues is to say that women's supporting feminism and women's issues will help men too. But there was no empathy for why, boys all around the world are falling behind girls in almost every academic subject, especially reading and writing, why boys are committing suicide equally to girls at the age of 9, but at the ages of 10 to 14, it's twice as much for boys as it is for girls. At the ages of 15 to 19, it's 4 times as much for boys as girls. At the ages of 20 to 24, it's almost 6 times as much for boys as girls. And so this is, you know, none of these issues that I talk about, the depression issues, the boys dropping out of high school, becoming unemployed, the need for vocational education for boys to be able to be successful in the employment area, so they're attracted to, they feel a sense of purpose, and they're also attracted to females. None of this was mentioned. And so I was deeply disappointed that she made this choice. Now, I'm somebody that's run for the Democratic candidacy for a governor in California. I'm not blind to political realities, but the political reality is that if Hillary Clinton had spoken up about boys and men's issues, no feminist that I know of would say, "Oh, you have empathy for boys and men? Okay, I'm going to vote for Trump as president." That was a non-possibility. And so here she had everything to gain, which was the attentive ear of mothers and fathers who had boys that were struggling, some of whom would have Republican leanings, some of whom would care, most of whom would care a lot more about their son's life being paid attention to than they would care about their party label. And everything I could say to make that change so that she would politically have about 100% gain and no loss was not heard. And so, yes, you're right. I'm afraid I have to say that the Hillary Clinton campaign definitely reinforced this sort of sense on the part of many mainstream Americans that there was no ear to the problems that the average family had struggling for, get food on the table. And this is one of the reasons I think she lost a significant amount of votes of white women, 52% of whom voted for Trump rather than her, and also lost a lot of the traditional labor support that Democrats usually get.
Dr. Farrell, I had no idea you were an advisor and that her assistants did not give that information to her, or it didn't reach her at the podium or get into her speeches. And related in a way, I noticed that when explaining some of the concepts in your book about, for example, sexism against men to some women friends, they went on the defense for women. And the implication is that when you talk about the reality of entrenched cultural biases against men, you're simultaneously messaging that women have it easy and don't experience similar biases. Well, you mentioned this type of thinking in your book, Why Men Are the Way They Are. Would you talk about this issue, please?
Yes, we are, unfortunately, we're biologically programmed. So we take it to the very deepest level, which is that historically, the way men got love from women, the way we got respect from parents, the way we got honor, we're called hero. The way we did that was risking our lives in war and risking our lives in the workplace. And two things have changed. One is that we have fewer men dying in war, and we don't have any great war that's threatening us. We don't have Nazis threatening to conquer the world and have us all be under Nazi rule. Fewer men are doing that now, are trained to die in war to save us. And secondly, because women are sharing more of the breadwinning burden, many women do not need men nearly as much as they used to be their economic security blanket. And so I think that what's happening at the deepest level is that the things that men were trained to do to save us created a type of toxicity in masculinity. That is, the toxicity in terms of we had to learn to repress our feelings, to not care, to tough it out, to not share what was going on inside of us. And so women learned to be okay with men being that way because they needed men to protect them and create economic security for them. So they didn't want men talking about their weaknesses or expressing their feelings, because a man who did that was not a sign of a man who would be able to protect them. They didn't want a man when they were up in bed together and there was a creak or a sound in the house, and they were in a three-story house, to say, well, why don't you and I both go together and see if there's a burglar, so we both have an equal chance of being hurt if
right.
there is one. And so that's, I think there's a deep anger inside women about men not being available for that role, and them only being able to see the negativity, the negative things men learned in order to be able to play that role. That's raw now and out there. And women are objecting to the toxicity and have made one huge error. And the huge error is saying that, historically speaking, we lived in a patriarchal society in which men made the rules to benefit men at the expense of women, and men had male privilege. In fact, we didn't live in a world dominated by a patriarchy. We lived in a world dominated by the need to survive. And to survive, men were willing to die to die so women would live and women would survive. And it wasn't male privilege to make rules that benefited women by having only men risk their lives in war, while women were saved and being allowed to be home and be precious and be more fragile and being cared for and being seen as having civilized values. They were able to have civilized values and be more precious because we protected them from the dirt and the scramble of the world that was ready to kill other men. So men who had their own type of sacrifice, and of course women had their type of sacrifice as well. Women were trained to be able to have children and to risk their lives in childbirth, even as men were trained to risk their lives in war to protect the children that women bore. So the misunderstanding of feminism has been that we didn't live in a world dominated by patriarchy. We lived in a world dominated by the need to survive. And the need to survive led most countries and societies to divide labor into women raising children and men raising money. And men and women didn't think, talk. My grandparents and my father, you know, didn't even talk about rights and privileges. He talked about responsibilities and obligations. When I said I wanted to write books, he said, "Warren, yes, you're a good writer, but you're not going to be able to write a books for a living. Only about 1% of authors get publishers, and if you can't find a publisher, you'll never find a wife. It's an irresponsible way to live your life." And so, you know, men have throughout history learned that to be the musician, the writer, the thinker, to do something even like teach in school, that was fine to teach in school until you had children. When you had children, maybe you should become an administrator. Maybe you should not get out of education altogether at underpay. It pays little. Become an insurance salesperson. Don't become a local insurance salesperson. Become a national sales insurance person, because even though it creates a father's catch-22, that is, it teaches you to learn to love your family by being away from the love of your family, you'll at least be able to support your family economically. You'll be able to be a better human doing. I don't really want you to be evaluating yourself as a human being.
Yeah, that is really fascinating, too, because in your 1986 book, Why Men Are the Way They Are, you broke down a lot of advertisements in feminist magazines, and not all of them, but some of them were women's magazines, and you pointed out some interesting insights in Ms. magazine ads from the 1980s for diamond rings and a De Beers diamond ring ad in Time magazine, and you asked the reader, quote, "If men are doing the buying, why are there so many ads in women's magazines?" Would you please talk about the role of corporate sales and marketing affecting those social dynamics of men and women?
Yes, people like De Beers diamonds, for example, they had all these ads in Ms. Magazine, and yet Ms. Magazine was presumably women bought, but men bought the diamonds, and the ads were making it really clear that women should, that the diamonds cost only about 3 months' salary, but when I looked at the size of the diamonds, in fact, those diamonds cost enough so that if a man was to use 3 months' salary to buy it, he would have had to earn more than $100,000 in 1970 money, which I don't know exactly what the translation is, but it's probably around $300,000 today. And so these women were being told to look for men who, you know, earn about $250,000 equivalent a year. And so then the next question is, well, why were, if men are buying these diamonds, you know, why is it that this is in women's magazines? And it was in women's magazines because the clear understanding of marketers was that that men would just skip right past these messages in men's magazines. But if it was a woman that was telling them that they wanted their diamond with with at least a carat and with a clarity and this type of color, that what the De Beers people call the three C's, that this importance of the three C's would get into women's psyches, who would then tell men, these three C's are important to me, who would then feel in turn the pressure to not just buy a diamond for a woman, even though he was not asking for a diamond for her himself, but to buy a diamond that had these three C's, and that even though, and that he shouldn't bother with a full carat diamond, to worry about whether that if he couldn't afford it on 3 months' income, on some level he was not worthy of this woman. And so this is the type of this is the type of power that women have without it ever being revealed to the woman, to herself, that women have this power. And this is what the feminists have not understood, that that women, just by their beauty power and the biology of men being addicted to women's beauty, that we are willing to do things that women want, as long as women tell us what they want. And so, I sometimes joke when I'm giving presentations that if women said, men, we will love you much more and we will certainly be more open to having sex with you if you walk on your hands. That really makes us turned on. Well, men would be having hand-walking contests starting tomorrow. and pretty soon we'd be, you know, having contests to walk on one hand. The point there being that women have this enormous power because of the biology of female beauty power being something to which men are addicted. And men spend, you know, you talk to almost any famous guitar player, and you ask him, what led you to playing the guitar? What led you to joining the band? And he'll say about 2/3 of the time, well, you know, I saw that women love guys that played guitars, so I got a guitar. And that's what has been completely overlooked by feminism, as they have honed victim power as a fine art. And rather than spend time focusing on both sexes, have been brought up not in a patriarchal world with male privilege, but both sexes were brought up historically to feel that they weren't going to be worthy of the other gender's attention unless they did certain things, and that both sexes had those mandates on them to be able to fall in love with the members of the other sex who were the most able to be, in women's case, fall in love with the men who could support you and the family the best. In men's case, fall in love with the women to whom you are addicted, the beautiful women and the young women.
I really enjoy how you take it back centuries. There are ancient lines that you can go back to and identify the same behavior because of these fundamentals that are involved here. You mentioned feminism a number of times here, and I thought it was interesting in your book, Why Men Are the Way They Are, that you've attributed some of the anger, and there are many reasons for women to be angry, but also you mentioned the victimization, and that's endless. You could, as you pointed out, create endless number of reasons to be a victim. But back to the anger, a lot of it you mentioned was coping with the anger of rejection, I think. Would you talk about how this may have changed in the last 3 decades since you've written the book?
Yes, I think there's more and less anger on women's part, more anger because on some level, you know, men aren't doing their savior role anymore. And so women are able to, and you know, women are required or expected to a much greater degree than they ever have been earning money and so on. And that's a pressure on a lot of women but yet men don't have oftentimes the emotional skills and the social skills to, when they're minus economic skills. Women sort of look at men that are sometimes less mature than they are, oftentimes less mature than they are. And so they contemplate, having a child before their time runs out, with either by themselves or with a man. And the men that they are around, they say to themselves, "Well, do I really want a man who's more of a child than a man? He's just one more child to support. And if he doesn't earn as much as I do or close to it, I feel like he is just one more child to support." And so there's, I think, a lot of very deep seething anger about that combination of losing the men as protectors to a greater degree, but yet men not having all the health intelligence skill sets that leave women focusing only on male toxicity and not on the sacrifices that men have historically made to create that toxicity. I'll deviate from the human realm for a moment to say, you were talking about the centuries of the way this has developed. And in fact, this has really developed over millions of years among insects, among birds, among animals. Women have almost always reproduced, been willing to be sexual, that is, and have children with the males who were the alpha males, not the whining males or the sweet, loving males. Women fell in love with the officer and the gentleman, not the private and the pacifist. And in animals, this is also true. And just one example is buck elks. Females fall in love with the buck elks that have the biggest antlers. or the biggest wreck. Consciously or unconsciously, the male that has the biggest wreck is the one likely to be able to reproduce and create the next generation. But to get that biggest wreck, you exhaust about 35% of your calcium, minerals, and nutrients. So if immediately after reproductive season, you do not get rid of that rack immediately by rubbing it against a tree to knock all those antlers in that rack off, you are highly likely to die if you're not able to replenish all those nutrients before the winter comes. So the male, that is the alpha male, that appears the strongest is actually the weakest of all the males. And one of the things I talk about in The Boy Crisis and The Myth of Male Power is that men's weakness is their facade of strength. Just like that elk's facade of strength was in fact his weakness. And that is the part of gender that feminism has completely looked over. Overlooked.
It's really profound, Dr. Farrell, and it reminds me of the other statement you made based on your research, in that how women are attracted to certain elements in men, and men are attracted to certain elements in women that do not sustain the relationship.
Correct. So what I talk about in both The Boy Crisis and also a book on that I did on relationships. I teach a lot of couples communication courses around the country because I found that, that divorces occur as a result of couples not communicating well. The single biggest problem in lack of communication is our inability to handle personal criticism without becoming defensive. And so if I wanted to have there be less of a boy crisis by having fewer fathers, I needed to work with couples on being able to communicate better so they didn't have divorces, so they didn't have less father involvement. But the summary point that you were getting at is that one of the things I sort of talk about is that both sexes fall in love with the members of the other sex who are the least capable of loving. Women fall in love with the most successful men as a rule, who are oftentimes the least, they have learned many skill sets in order to become successful at work that are the opposite of the skill sets needed to be successful in love. A CEO, for example, needs to learn while he's listening to think about hundreds of other variables, such as, is this product that I'm being sold by this person? Is this the best product on the market? What are some other possible competitors that I should check out? Would this product fit into my Chinese branch and so on? So he needs to focus while somebody is talking to him about everything else, the many, many other factors that he needs to ask questions about in order to become a successful CEO or a successful lawyer, whether this person is a male or a female. But when this lawyer or this CEO comes home, and when his wife or children are talking, if he's focused on a whole bunch of questions he needs to ask or the challenges he needs to make, his wife and children don't feel listened to and heard. So that's one of the ways that women fall in love with the members of the other sex that are the least capable of loving them. And men are programmed to fall in love with the women who are the youngest and the most beautiful. Women who are younger aren't, as a rule, as mature as women who are older and have more life experience and more knowledge of what love really is. And women who are the most beautiful are the ones that oftentimes don't learn to support themselves and don't learn to be fully engaged in careers because other men are competing to pay for them. And so both sexes tend to fall in love with the members of the other sex who are the least capable of loving them. And then they blame the person who they fall in love with for the flaws that they fell in love with.
Love is in the Balance concludes this heavily researched book, and women using love to transcend the need to find an enemy in men, which I thought was really, really good to put down. Yet this is part of a four-quadrant matrix you've identified, and it really nicely ties up the book. Would you share this with listeners, please?
Yes, I'm saying that historically what we've done is taken a magnifying glass to women's experience of powerlessness, and also a magnifying glass to a second quadrant, which is women's experience of male power. And I'm happy about that, and I'm happy to have made a contribution toward that end as a male feminist. However, what we've completely missed is men's experience of powerlessness and men's experience of women's power. That needs to be part of the quadrilogue, if you will. Part of the, those four quadrants always need to be discussed in any discussion of gender. But also, this is just the basics, of course. What we have in reality with feminists is we have not women's experience of powerlessness and women's experience of men's power, but liberal or feminist women's experience of powerlessness and liberal or feminist women's experience of male power. We don't have this from conservative women nearly as much. We don't have this from trans women nearly as much. And on the male side, we have liberal men's experience of, we don't have anything from men, either liberal or conservative or trans. And so there's multiple dimensions of gender that have to all be looked at. But and we have only looked at two of the quadrants, or really two of the many multiple dimensions of male-female relationships, and made conclusions about males' privilege and patriarchy based on that. And that has undermined our ability to love each other when, for the first time in history, with survival being more capable of being reached, we have more opportunity to really love each other, not as role mates as we did in the old days, but as soulmates. And that is my hope for the future.
That also may explain why there is a lack of proper reception of the boy crisis, because of the lack of that quadrilogue.
Yes, I think that is absolutely the case. And so sadly, that there is so much more receptivity on the part only of conservatives. And I'm so glad that, you know, conservatives are responsive, but I'm so sad that those of us that call ourselves progressive are not progressive enough to integrate the male experience, in addition to not being aware that the word progressive is a self-righteous term that makes many people who don't agree with us feel like we think that we have all the answers, and anybody that disagrees with us has none.
Dr. Warren Farrell, it's really been a delight to have you on the show and talk about your book, Why Men Are the Way They Are. And I hope to have you back on to talk about your recent book titled The Boy Crisis. Thank you so much for being on In Other News.
I'm always happy to be responsive to a person as thoughtful as you are. It's just really a pleasure.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.